I'm Mark Golub, and in the news, the spiraling brouhaha over Representative Omar's and Representative Tlaib's attempts to bash Israel unabashedly by planning a trip to Israel and calling the Jewish state Palestine, and by refusing to meet with any representative of the Netanyahu government or with any member of the Israeli opposition. Omar and Tlaib, each of whom support BDS, the single most politically immoral movement on the planet Earth today, are committed to nothing less than Israel's destruction. Think about that. Think about the fact that two sitting members of Congress support BDS, a movement founded by a vicious Palestinian terrorist, Omar Baghouri, with the express purpose of destroying a nation state of the United Nations, the state of Israel. The BDS mantra is, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. In other words, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, there is no place for the state of Israel. It is all Palestine. That's what two sitting members of Congress effectively espouse. Israel has never before denied entry to a sitting member of the U.S. Congress. To the contrary, Israel has always welcomed members of Congress, has shown them what Israel is all about, permitted them to go anywhere they wish, to speak to anyone they wish. But the visits were always in good faith by members of Congress honestly interested in learning about the dynamics of the Middle East, even if they were sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Their sympathy, however, never included an attempt to destroy Israel, never was in support of BDS. Israel drew a line. Even a U.S. member of Congress, especially a U.S. member of Congress, may not travel to Israel calling it Palestine and create photo ops that would distort the truth about Israel and about Israeli treatment of Palestinians, and have no doubt that's what would have happened. The suggestion that Israel chosen the lesser of two evils and permitted two congresswomen to visit their Jewish state, the suggestion that the matter would have come and gone without incidents, it's at best disingenuous, at worst it's myopic or malevolent. Their visit to delegitimize Israel would have been a media frenzy. The larger problem Israel has, the problem Jewish leadership has everywhere, is that the average person knows little to nothing about the realities of Israeli society, Israeli civil rights, Israeli tolerance of dissent and criticism, even tolerance of literal calls of sedition by the enemies of Israel, how Israel protects its minorities, especially its Muslim Arab minorities, and how the only reason Israel is currently administering the West Ridge is because the Palestinians are led by fanatics who will only be satisfied with from the river to the sea. This issue has been framed all wrong, not simply by the media, but by Jewish leadership, who've adopted the narrative that Israel was at least short-sighted in its ban of Omar and Tlaib, if not weak and afraid. Instead of trying to justify Israel's mistake, suggesting all the ways Israel could have handled the issue better and wiser, Jewish leadership should be hammering on the lies and deceptions and wholly un-American attempts to destroy this country's greatest democratic ally, Israel. The emphasis should be on all the lies being told by Ilhan Omar when she holds a press conference and suggests Israel is not a real democracy, that Israel is denying human rights to Palestinians, and that the U.S. should rethink its foreign aid to Israel. It is out. All of it is outrageous. And that's what every Jewish leader should have been saying over and over and over again. It's outrageous that members of Congress are not as one condemning Omar's comments and censuring Tlaib and Omar for even suggesting a trip to Palestine. Instead, Steny Hoyer calls Israel's decision to bar entry to Omar and Tlaib, he calls that outrageous. And when Donald Trump says that Jews who support the Democratic Party are being disloyal to Israel and their Jewish people, that the American Jewish Community calls outrageous. In the Jewish community, there's a growing, frightening split. Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of the Reform Movement's Union for Reform Judaism, suggests Israel has acted recklessly, while Mort Klein and the Zionist Organization of America focuses on the egregious anti-Israel lies of Representative Omar and Representative Tlaib. Now, where should the emphasis be? I've received many emails from viewers in response to my op-eds, both in writing and here on JBS, where I've tried to make the point that the focus is all wrong, that Israel is at war with an enemy who wants nothing less than to destroy it, and that tragically, two freshman members of the United States Congress have joined in that war against Israel. What should Jewish reaction be, especially among Jews who care deeply about the safety and well-being of the state of Israel? And I want to show you one email, just an average JBS viewer sent me, just one of many, many on this topic. She writes, "I am just one older woman who isn't very important in today's affairs, except to totally agree with you regarding your commentary on these two radical congresspersons who are anti-Israel. I am Catholic from my mother's side. My grandfather was Jewish. I know if he were alive today, how he would love Israel and how proud he would be. I called my congressman, Sherrod Brown, and left a message that he should speak out on behalf of Israel. It saddens my heart what's happening. These radicals need to be called out. Please know how proud I am of you. I watch JBS daily. I hope this humble note reaches you. Peace be with you, Pamela of Stowe, Ohio, who watches on DirecTV channel 388. Well, there are so many wrinkles now to this issue. And so for some real analysis, I'm so pleased to be joined once again by Thane Rosenbaum, distinguished fellow at NYU Law School, the founding director of the Forum on Law, Culture, and Society, and an award-winning novelist whose upcoming book coming out in March is entitled Saving Free Speech from Itself. Thane, thank you for joining us once again.
Always, Mark.
Thane, I want to begin with the comments that Omar made after she was denied entry to the State of Israel, suggesting that Israel is somehow not a real democracy and that the United States should be rethinking foreign aid to Israel. In general, by the way, what's your reaction to the whole brouhaha?
Well, you know, you may remember I wrote an essay in which I said that I thought that the Congresswoman should be allowed. By the way, I could have made an equal argument on why they shouldn't be allowed. In fact, I might have made a better argument. But I'll tell you why I said they should be allowed.
Yes.
It's for the very reason that you're describing her saying, making a press conference and saying, Israel's not a real democracy. You know, if people think I'm effective as an advocate for Israel, and you've been very kind and generous in that praise, I need to be able to say to the world, and I say it all the time, there are 22 failed Arab states, laughably failed, in every way. No one's going to win a Nobel Prize in any of these places. They are theocratic. They're oppressive. They jail journalists and jurists. They're stoning of women, dismembering of women, lashing of women, torching of homosexuals. This is the Arab Muslim world, especially under Sharia law. 22 Arab countries, there's one Jewish state, a vibrant democracy, an open and free society, respects the rule of law, a completely robust journalism that oftentimes is critical of the Israel's government and policies, where women can wear anything they want and gay men can do anything they want without any fear. And I need to be able to constantly point this out. And I don't want someone like Tlaib or Omar to say, it's not a real democracy, because she used that moment, her denial of being entry into Israel, to point, that's what she was pointing to. She was saying, well, you know, I thought this was supposed to be a democracy. If it's such a democracy, how come my colleague and I were
not?
Is
she right?
No, look, she's right in this sense, and that's where I cringe. There were two moments that I cringe.
Yes.
The first you already point out. She used the word Palestine. Those are fighting words. There's no country Palestine. There wasn't a country Palestine. You know, so this is part of this confusion, right? You say the word Palestine a number of times, and people think that actually there was a country, that the Palestinians lived there, and the Jews somehow came and took away their land, instead of saying, well, you know, the towns and villages of the West Bank are all mentioned in the Old Testament, and the word Jerusalem appears nearly 700 times, and in the Quran, the word Jerusalem doesn't appear once. Right, and I hope JBS viewers already know this, but it's not. Please remember this when you're talking to some imbecile at dinner and doesn't know this. Say, if Jerusalem is so important to Muslims, how come it wasn't mentioned in their book? And why is the Old Testament filled with the very towns that are now part of the West Bank? That doesn't mean that there couldn't be an Arab society. As you know, for many years, I once was in favor of two-state solution.
You still are.
I'm not really.
You are still, in theory, you are.
I am and I'm not. But let me just say, so for me, it's important to at least always be able to say 22 failed states, one vibrant.
I'm asking you a specific question. Yeah. Is Israel's refusing to allow Omar and Tlaib in undemocratic?
No, let me just say something about this.
No.
I'll tell you why.
No.
Well, let me tell you why that no one else talking about, which is, and or at least I haven't heard anyone talk about. Again, I could have written this essay, but I didn't, which is that if you're a congressperson, you're saying, especially a member of Congress can be critical and always be free to enter Israel. Yes, your point is the correct point. A congressman with an open mind who has criticisms of Israel.
No problem.
But the BDS movement, I mean, when you come into Israel in favor of the BDS movement, you lose your diplomatic credentials. Whatever diplomatic capacity you think you had, they're gone. So don't point to your Congress badge and say, I'm a member of Congress. Because I don't know, in the course of history, King Henry VIII did not let people into court who believed in the end of England. Nobody is invited and given the treatment of a diplomat if their whole purpose is to be undiplomatic.
Has America ever denied diplomats entry into this country?
No, and yet...
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
No, in our country, of course.
Of course.
Of course, and in all throughout Western democracies.
Yes, and it doesn't make us non-democratic.
No, of course.
It didn't make Israel non-democratic.
Of course.
Okay, so when Omar...
But in this case, it's particularly true because
that?
In other... No, because in the United States or the United Kingdom, you see situations where a leader who has been responsible for mass death or some horrible treatment to say, look, we're not honoring you in the same way, which is different in this case here because these people are saying, we don't believe in the country of Israel at all.
Exactly.
We don't want it to exist.
Exactly.
And so the Israelis really can take the position, then you're not a diplomat.
So why are you critical of Israel? Because it makes it harder for you to call it a democracy.
I'm not being critical. My view of it was to say, if in the essay, what I said was, come to Israel, but before you start your campaign of
they wouldn't have come, and Israel knew they wouldn't have come. I only have one. I want to hear what Thane Rosenbaum has to say. Was there anything correct in Omar's statement that Israel is not a real democracy, and that Israel is brutalizing Palestinians, not giving them an opportunity for freedom, mm-hmm. and that Israel and that the U.S. should rethink its aid to Israel. Well, the U.S. should rethink its aid to Israel. Well, anything there resonate with you?
Well, remember, those comments were made after they were denied, right?
Yes.
No, I'm just saying, just in terms of the time frame, was after. I already said the word Palestine is itself a
provocative. But you seemed upset that Israel didn't let them in.
I wasn't. I, if you read my essay, what I was really interested in, it was pointing out the many ways in which Israel stands out as a free society as opposed to any other Arab country. So what I said in the essay is, come to Israel, but under one condition. You'll go anywhere you want. But first, the cameras need to follow you to see the Ethiopian Miss Israel. And you have to go and talk to, you have to go to a concert in Tel Aviv and see gays and women and sitting there. You have to go to SodaStream from the West Bank when they were in the West Bank and see Jews and Arabs sitting together. You need to see that this is not an apartheid state, that if you're going to bring your cameras, show Israel for what it is. And then if at that point you want, after you've actually seen what a free society, it might be confusing to you because there is no other Arab society that would be so free.
Okay, so we agree then.
Right.
I am pushing you all only because you seem to be saying you wished Israel had done something different.
I wished that the opportunity to have them come and see a society that is a free, open, liberal, pluralistic, respect for the rule of law society, because most people don't know this.
They wouldn't have seen that.
Yeah, well, that's possibly true. Short of that. But
they wouldn't have seen
but
that.
But short of that, no, I have no problem with two people who believe in the destruction of a country not being invited and welcomed to come to the country as if.
Thane, my point to our audience is the subject is being discussed upside down. Yeah. Israel has to be justified. Israel shouldn't be justified here. What should be happening is everyone, including within the Democratic Party, and I don't even want to make it by parties, everybody in Congress, every congressperson, Steny Hoyer wants to use the words outrageous. It wasn't outrageous that Israel said, we're not going to let BDS people into America, into Israel. What Steny Hoyer should have said is, it's outrageous that a sitting member of Congress would support BDS.
Right.
And it's outrageous that you go and call Israel a so-called democracy.
Well, it's also
I want Steny Hoyer to be outraged by that. I want every congressperson, and I want to know from you, and you have a sense of this. Why aren't they?
Look, part of the problem is the Democratic Party. Part of the problem is the spinelessness of Pelosi and Schumer. They're afraid of being primaried. They're afraid of what happened with the Republicans when moderate Republicans lost election to Tea Party people. This is what they're afraid of. They're not being, the squad should be disciplined by the Democratic leadership. Mm-hmm. But the Democratic leadership, they're all afraid of being primaried on their own side. Guys like Schumer afraid that some progressive is going to show up.
So is Elliot Engel.
Everyone is afraid that a progressive is going to show up and someone who is going to proudly say, I'm a Democratic Socialist, and AOC is going to support them. So part of the problem is the Democratic Party has no leadership in this issue. That's number one. Number two, what your viewers are seeing with what just happened with Tlaib and Omar is what I live through every day on university campuses. Mm-hmm. They're getting a taste of it. Mm-hmm. I would like to say to your viewers, JBS viewers, welcome to my world. Mm-hmm. Right? This is new to you. This is old hat for me. What you're seeing now in Democratic politics on the progressive side is this sort of this intersectional mythology that white people are responsible for crimes committed against dark-skinned people that they simply have to atone for. And if you're a dark-skinned person, you are granted immediate virtue, automatic virtue. And if you're a white-skinned person, you are immediately to be blamed. And that's what life is like on a university campus. And that's why when you saw the anti-Semitic statements coming out of Omar, and there was a bill, this was a number of months ago, I think back in the spring, there was an anti-Semitism bill, and then all of a sudden it was watered down to a general Correct. Discrimination bill.
Yes.
And why is it? Well, because anti-Semitism was a white guy's problem. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't possibly condemn a dark-skinned female congresswoman. We can't do that in this political culture, just like you couldn't do it on a campus. There is a special virtue, a special pass that's given that you would grant no one else. And so that's why you're seeing a helpless Democratic leadership letting these four congresswomen run the table.
Okay, so I want to come to the helpless Democratic leadership. You have now brought us to the most recent flap. President Trump says any Jew who votes for the Democrat in the upcoming election, given where the Democratic Party is on Israel, is disloyal, and what he clarified was disloyal to the Jewish people in the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. So I want your reaction to that.
Look, the problem is the president is not a well-read man. I mean, let's face it. I mean, there's two things that here. This is the first time he's ever heard the word dual loyalty. I don't think he understands how loaded that is, even with a Jewish son-in-law. I don't think he understood that. I don't. That's number one.
Where was the dual loyalty?
There isn't, but the word loyalty is what got...
You mean, anytime the word
disloyalty
uses loyalty, it must be associated with dual loyalty?
In our culture, the speed with which people take...
That is a gross
you're talking
distortion.
You are talking to a guy, as you remember, and you've said this on your show many times, who wrote an essay during Gaza that was written in the Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
And people walked away from an 800-word essay that they can go look at right now and said Thane Rosenbaum believes in the killing of Palestinian children.
He does. Yeah, that's what they said.
That's what they said. And you know
vicious.
What that's called?
It was vicious.
That's called a gross distortion. In this political...
Well, I'm against that gross distortion.
I know that.
I'm just saying,
I'm not agreeing with you.
Okay.
I'm simply saying, I wish the president hadn't used the word disloyalty.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that...
Okay, fine.
It doesn't mean...
Is he right?
Look,
Is he right?
Let me just answer it. To a large extent, he is right.
Because, he is right.
Yes, and let me tell you why. Because Jews have for years said, we're not just a religion. We're a religion and a people. We are a religion and a nation. And if that's true, and by the way, we were charged with dual loyalty when we weren't a nation. We were just a people before Israel. For years, wherever we were accused of dual loyalties. It was loyalty not even to a nation, to another religion. So if, in fact, Jews are both a religion and a people and connected to a larger religion, his point is the same point that Eric Cantor once said to me on the stage of the 92nd Street Y. I don't for the life of me understand why 80% of American Jews support the Democratic Party. He's saying, I don't understand. Why would they? And I think that this is essentially what you're hearing from President Trump. He's saying, for the life... Now, I think, unfortunately, he framed it in terms of disloyalty to Israel. And that only happened because we had this aborted trip that was planned by these two female congressmen, who then on the very next day purported to say that Israel is not a democracy. But he didn't use the word dual loyalty. He used the word disloyalty.
It had nothing to do with dual loyalty.
I think that what he's largely saying is the same thing Eric Cantor and a number of Republicans have said, which is, what is it with the Democratic Party, with you people?
That's all he was saying.
Iran deal?
All right.
What is it with you Jewish Democrats that you see these things and you're willing to excuse anything simply because it's the party of Franklin Roosevelt?
Okay.
Instead of saying, don't you really think the Republicans are more loyal, at least, let's not use the word loyal, but they understand the virtue of having a democratic ally in the Middle East called Israel. And unlike President Obama, who didn't joyfully beat up on Israel, the Trump administration, nor did the George W. Bush administration, have any reason to beat up on the Israeli government.
Okay. If I say, I'm going to say this to you. Donald Trump says many things that you say to yourself, what in the world is he thinking? And why would a president ever say that? Or sometimes it's obnoxious, and sometimes it's stupid, and sometimes it's silly. And we don't want a president to act or say whatever comes to his mind anytime he wants to say it. So if somebody says to me, you know, I'm very critical of a president who would say anything like that, it's just not appropriate for a president to say that, I have no problem. But if somebody wants to talk about the content of what this man said, the only problem for me is most Jews don't feel what Donald Trump assumes we feel. Most American Jews, Thane, do not have an overriding love for the state of Israel. They don't really care what happens to Israel.
And they don't know anything.
And they don't know anything. And so for them, it's not about being loyal
or
disloyal.
You're saying you think President Trump believes that they do have those feelings.
Yes, he gives Jews much more credit than we deserve. He shouldn't have said it, but it's not that it isn't true. For Jews who care deeply about the state of Israel, those of us who've grown up, lifelong Democrats, we got to ask what you just talked about, the failure of Democratic, I'm using your word now, leadership.
Yes.
Okay. And if that's true, what I want to see happen is I want all the Jews who have been passionate supporters of the Democratic Party for very good social reasons, I want them now to demand that the Pelosis and the Schumers and the Steny Hoyers and every non-Jewish member of Congress and every Jewish member of Congress say in no uncertain terms, Representative Omar, Representative Tlaib, you're way out of line and you can't be part of the mainstream of this party if you continue to take a BDS attitude. I want Jewish Democrats to be influential in changing Democratic.
It's not going to happen.
Why not?
Well, first of all, it has a lot to do with wanting to get invited to the right parties. And I don't mean not just the Democratic Party. I mean, American Jews, you know, it's interesting because I write so often, I get a lot of mail. There are actually a lot of American Jews that are very defensive about Donald Trump because of the positions that he's taken in support of Israel. But most American Jews are critical of President Trump. And they would in any way, they would be embarrassed in front of their neighbors to take a position that would make them appear as if they're supporting the Trump administration. And by the way, in terms of what I said before about the Democratic leadership, what bothers me most about it, aside from the overall spinelessness, is the hypocrisy. Because when a guy like Stephen King, God forbid anything is said about the squad and their color or their intelligence or their, you know, the charges of racism are invoked so quickly now in the United States. So the question is, it's amazing how quickly Pelosi and Schumer would attack anyone who said anything negative about the squad that would be even remotely connected to a racist comment. But here, when it comes to Jews, why? Well, part of it is because they're afraid of being primaried. And the second is going to the point that I said about intersectionality. What Jews have allowed to have happen, maybe they couldn't have stopped it, but what's happened in this country is Jews are simply wealthy, rich people, white people. They're wealthy white people. They have no connection to minority status, to ethnic status, and to having a history of persecution. It's shocking to think that that's, you're saying that Jews have no history of persecution? Yes, most, certainly in a university setting, and certainly in intellectual magazines, the Holocaust is irrelevant, and Jews are privileged. They're white, privileged people. And so they have no claim to any of these sympathies that we would ordinarily grant to ethnic people, to minority people, to first-generation people, to people with darker skin. This simply, these courtesies, these sympathies simply do not apply to Jews. And that's why, you know, the anti-Semitism bill didn't pass, and instead it was changed to an anti-discrimination bill. That's why no one wants to hear about the Holocaust anymore, because that's old news and because it doesn't fit the narrative. What's the narrative? Jews are white privileged people, and they have deserved no special pleading. And Israel is not some tiny country surrounded by 22 hostile countries that has been attacked numerous times, and even today faces not just existential threats from Iran, but ongoing terroristic tactics from the same poor Palestinians that we're talking about here with Klaib, as if to say, I don't know if we've talked about what Bill Maher said the other day on his show.
You should say.
It was extraordinary, right? It was absolutely extraordinary. He said, you know, this idea of intersectionality plays to some kind of bizarre myth that the Palestinians are brown, so they're probably right, and the Jews are white, so they're probably wrong. And the Palestinians, there was no intifadas and no suicide bombings. The Palestinians were just simply sitting there growing olives, and the Israelis came in and took their land. Now, I know this sounds absurd, but that's what most people think. That's the limit of what they know, that this is clearly a colonialist enterprise, Jews coming in to take other people's land. And the Palestinians have been this unbelievably innocent people. I mean, in my view, I've written this before, I can't think of a group of people with less sympathy than the Palestinians. I honestly can't. They invented terrorism. Our whole lives are built around preventing terrorism, and these are the people that perfected it. You know, these are people that have conducted the kind of terrorist activities that's utterly barbarism, slitting the throats of children, setting people on fire, throwing men in wheelchairs off of ships. When you think of other truly occupied people, the Kashmiri, the Tibetans, the Kurds, the Cypriots, why aren't we talking about them?
Mention the gentleman you spoke to and his reference to 1967.
Oh, you love that.
I love that.
It's a horrible, it's both a wonderful and horrible anecdote. My neighbor in my building in Brooklyn, who is Irish, not American Irish, but Irish, heard that I was a writer and that I appear on television about Middle East issues. So he decided to come up to me to demonstrate his knowledge that he could go toe-to-toe with some human rights law professor. So he said to me, I understand you're a writer and you write and talk about the Middle East and you're a law professor. And I said, this is true. And then he said, you know, I'm Irish. And I said, I know that. I can hear it in your voice. And he said, I assume you're Jewish. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, you know, we Irish hate Israel. And I said, yeah, I know that. And I never understood why. Right. He actually said one interesting thing. He said, well, you know, we, because of the IRA, were always sympathetic to the PLO. So that was one interesting thing. We had our own factions that fought against us. But he then said, let me tell you what we know, the Irish. This is what people in Ireland know, that when Israel was created in 1967, they immediately went into Palestine and stole the land of the Palestinians. And I was...
He used the year... 1967.
Yeah, he picked the year. The year that Israel was created was 1967, mm-hmm. went into another country that existed as a country called Palestine. Mm-hmm. Right? Remember, you and I know, and I hope the viewers of JBS know, in 1967, the West Bank was occupied by the Jordanians, and no one used the word occupation. Wow! The same land dispute, the same land... There wasn't one Jew living nowhere. There were no settlements. There wasn't one Jew anywhere in the West Bank. Remember, Jews didn't even have the Wailing Wall was the Wailing Wall because we didn't have any access to the Wailing Wall. In 1967, the West Bank was occupied by Jordanians who had absolutely no claim to the land, and no one on this planet called the land occupied. But here, this guy thinks Israel was created in 67, and its first thing it did was go take land away from another country that once existed.
This is frightening to me.
Yeah, and I literally said to him, this was the final comment, I said, I don't want to give you his name, I said, do you understand that every single thing you said is factually wrong? And you know what he said? That's what you say.
Right, yes, that's right.
And yeah. I said to him, yeah. I know, but you came up to me and said, I'm a law professor and I've written about it and I speak about it. So I thought you were showing me the respect that I might know something. And I said, look, you know, honestly, you need to do some reading. Right? I said, you need to, and he said, that's what you say, as if to say, we all have our own truths. That's your sense of the history, but there's this other sense of the history. By the way, this is why I'm always worried when people say, you know, fake news, facts are not facts, because we need to take positions that there are some things that we can judge and some things that we declare to be true. So yes, this is what we're fighting against. And this is one of the reasons, not you and me, but we're fighting up against this large ignorance. And when we started this conversation, this is the reason why I would have accepted bringing them to Israel as long as the cameras were following them, actually seeing Israel.
By the way, I was very ambivalent. And in the op-ed piece I wrote, I did not take a position. What I really said was, I will understand if Israel does, I will yeah. understand if Israel doesn't, then I'm going to support Israel either way. Israel chose not to. They explained to me, I thought in very cogent terms, why they decided not to. There was an issue about whether it was Netanyahu buckling under to Trump's tweet was really, would Israel have let them in without, if Trump had never tweeted?
Why, do you think it mattered?
I don't think it matters, but there are many.
You're saying the position would have been the same regardless
yes,
of what?
Yes, I believe that what happened was Israel did not realize that the itinerary called their trip a trip to Palestine. I don't think they realized till later that they were refusing to meet with anybody. Not only, again, this is important. It's one thing for them to say, we don't want to meet with anybody in the Netanyahu government. I think that's wrong. But let's say their answer was, we will only meet with the opposition, or we'll only meet with, you know, Arabs, but we won't meet with anybody who represents the formal state of Israel, but we'll meet with, you know, other people who are involved in Israeli life. Yes, we will go to Yad Vashem. Yes, we will have a sense, we will meet with the Arab Israeli who's a member of the Supreme Court.
Well, I said that in my essay. I said,
yes, you did.
I said there have been several Arab Israelis serving on the Supreme
Correct.
Court. And if anyone knows what a definition of apartheid is, there is no such thing as apartheid where there would have been a black woman who would have been Miss South Africa. But in Israel, a former Ethiopian was Miss Israel. There wouldn't have been any black South Africans sitting on the Supreme Court
Correct.
Of South Africa.
Of course.
There wouldn't have been blacks and whites sitting on public transportation together.
Correct.
They wouldn't have had blacks sitting in the House of Parliament
yes.
arguing against the even existence of the country
yes.
itself.
Yes.
And by the way, I pointed out in my essay that if they had met with the Arab Knesset members who serve as Knesset members in a free parliamentary system, they would discover that the Arabs these women are Muslims, they don't speak as freely in Congress as Arab Israelis do in the Knesset. I mean, that's something to think about, that these four, the squad, would never speak against the United States in the way that Arab Knesset members speak against Israel.
Yes.
That's a free society.
Yes.
And that's what I want.
And what's Haaretz?
Haaretz, I pointed out also. Haaretz doesn't exist here in the United States at all. Haaretz is, and you know, it was started by intellectuals. It's the far extreme newspaper. It has an influence.
Far left.
Far left, far left. It is an influence far out of disproportion given its numbers.
Very small
because
circulation,
because it has,
right.
like, not many people buy it, but it does have an intellectual bent.
And it's a big deal here in America and to American jury.
And it's exploited among American jury as if it has a voice. And the truth is, if you read the columnists for Haaretz and what they say daily about the Israeli government, there isn't anything like that. If you want to talk about freedom of the press, mm-hmm. the United States could learn something from mm-hmm. the Israelis. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not sure the Americans would tolerate Haaretz out of New York or out of any or the center of power here. The Israelis do. And you know what that's called? A free, open, pluralistic, liberal society that respects the rule of law, that is democratic at its core, and has a freestanding press. And that's what I would want. I'm saying, since my neighbor thinks Israel was created in 1967, and that instead, remember how that was flipped the way he saw the story. Remember, Israel's created in 1948, and five Arab countries attack it on its first day. His story was Israel was created in 67. On its first day, it attacked an Arab country and took its land. Do you realize how ugly and pernicious a lie that
is? Of course.
How really vulgar a lie, right? You mean to say that you've turned the story that was true, that should have given you all the sympathy to Israel, and turned it so that all the sympathy should be given to Palestinians?
Okay, there are going to be people watching us right now, and they're going to be asking you, how did Israel let that happen? How is it that first of all, the word narrative just drives me crazy.
Why aren't you talking
narrative
about?
Is a story.
Yeah.
You know, I was a child, there'd be narratives. A fairy tale is a narrative.
As opposed to history.
Yes, as right. opposed to history.
Like what you remembered also
yes,
as a child that
also,
you don't mess with.
That's right.
Right.
And in 1984 was the depiction of what happens if a society destroys its history,
yeah.
and it's rewritten anytime
yeah.
things change. So there is a history here,
yeah.
which your neighbor totally disregards.
Neither
that's
worse.
And his answer is, "Oh, you have your own history,
exactly.
but it's not the true history."
No, it's worse than that. The guy who he said is the writer, law professor, Middle East expert. Oh, that's what you say.
Yes.
Instead of saying, but, well, you probably might know something.
Yes. Now, there are going to be people saying, however, Thane and Mark, how did Israel
yeah.
and these, you know, the Jewish people are supposed to be smart. We talk about all the Nobel Prize winners, and yet we have lost the battle for truth that, lo and behold, you have to come here and I'm not... I understand the reach JBS has and the reach it doesn't have. This is not MSNBC. This is not CNN. It's not Fox. This is a Jewish channel. Many, many non-Jews watch us. We're in 49 million homes, but you know, we have, relatively speaking, a smaller niche audience. So people who watch us, Jew or non-Jew, they're going to hear this. But the larger American public doesn't. And I have a follow-up question, but take just one quick moment. Why is it that the truth, the simple truth, is not so well known that an Omar and a Talib can get up as members of Congress and just lie? It's not that they're shading it. And no one's saying the Palestinians don't have it tough. They do, but for reasons. Let's have the reasons, please. And everybody knows, if tomorrow Israel put down all its guns, there'd be no Israel the next day. And if the Palestinians decided to stop all incitement, stop all terrorism, stop all of the Jews are the descendants of pigs and apes, and that we used the blood of children for matzah, if all that were wiped away, one day, the next day there would be peace, total peace. Why is it we, in the larger Jewish community, have not been successful in creating that greater context so that when Talib and Omar get up, everybody knows it's ludicrous. What they're saying is ludicrous. Why?
Two very quick reasons. One, that's related to why people are fixated on Palestinians and are not fixated on human rights violations all over the world when you have really serious, gross human rights violations, which is that it's far more appealing. It's a case of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
The oppressors of Palestinians
yes.
are Jews.
Okay.
And this is so...
Of course.
This, I mean, it's the only...
Well, you say it so simply and obviously,
yeah,
right?
I mean, it's so, how could anyone dispute this?
Okay, and now...
Because no one seems to care about 500,000 Syrians that have been, many of whom, gassed by their own people. No one cares. You look around the world, you see unbelievable human rights violations. Again, and you look at the sheer overall sheer little few numbers. You know, people talk about, and I've said this before on JBS, the word, forget apartheid, ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. I gave the JBS audience, I said, the next time someone says something about Jerusalem, I said, here's something, ethnic cleansing. Since the occupation, Mark, the Palestinian population has doubled. I don't know about you, but genocides require subtractions. You don't get to multiply. You don't double. You can't use the word ethnic cleansing or genocide if your population has doubled. Now, talk about a factual distortion. How are we letting anybody in our university campuses use the word ethnic cleansing? You don't think there should be mathematicians or history professors that are going, whoa, wait a minute. This is vulgar. This is a historical outrage. So yes, there's no question that anti-Semitism is the primary reason, because Israel is a tiny country. It is not a perfect democracy, but it is a democracy. And the number of Palestinian people that are killed compared to, for many reasons of their own doing, because they won't give up violence, they will not give up the rejectionism of the United of Israel, compared to the sheer volume of people that are killed around the world that no one ever hears about. So what's the only thing that could explain it? Anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. because in none of those other places are Jews the purported oppressors. And the second thing is, the Jewish opinion makers, the Jewish writers, the Jewish editors, the Jewish producers, the people that are in a position to tell, not the narrative, but the truth, won't.
Because?
Because they like, because Wolf Blitzer likes looking himself on CNN. That's what he likes. And when you watched his coverage of Gaza, it was sad for a child of Holocaust survivors to deliver that reportage. And Wolf, I hope you're watching. It was disgraceful. And so for a guy who's a child of Holocaust survivors to be that critical of Israel and during Gaza and to have nothing to say about Palestinian rockets or terrorism, rejectionism, everywhere you go, we see Jews who could have made a difference who won't and won't do it because they like their jobs, they like their life, and they don't have the moral courage to stand up for their own people.
We only have a few more minutes, and I want to deal with one more issue with you. I want to set it up. You know, the Jewish people created the phrase never again. And in the Jewish community, the idea of never again is never should there be another Holocaust. Never should Jews be the victims as we were in World War II, under Nazi Germany. There's an attempt every now and then to make never again a larger issue. I'm not sympathetic to that, although I understand the Jew also cares. There should not be any peoples who are the victims the way the Jews were once victims in the Holocaust, and there never have been. But there's another dimension to never again, which the Jew means. The Jew also means never again will the Jew be quiet? Mm-hmm. Will the Jew be silent? Will the Jew be afraid to speak out and to confront? And very much of that is made about the American Jewish community during the Holocaust. That American Jewry was told by its leadership, Shah, be still. Don't make waves for Roosevelt. Roosevelt doesn't want this to be a Jewish war. We will stay quiet.
Stephen Wise,
exactly.
A rabbi.
And there are many survivors who don't forgive American Jews because we were silent.
Yeah.
Okay. So in my mind, never again means Jews will not be silent. Now, you know, I have, you know, people sometimes write to me, how come you're so nice to people you disagree with? I happen to think they're lovely people. We disagree. We have profound disagreements. But many of the people who I disagree with, I also happen to think they're wrong, but they're not evil, you know? And there are certain people who I adore. I adore David Harris. I adore Abe Foxman. I adore Malcolm Honlein. I adore a whole, I disagree with Eric. I adore Eric Yaffe. But And I have a very lovely relationship with Rick Jacobs. I disagree with Rick Jacobs. But what has happened in this whole controversy of late is that, in my mind, Jewish leadership is frightened to take Omar and Tlaib on.
Yeah.
They're frightened.
Yeah.
And when I hear the AJC say, well, the real problem with Israel taking a principled stand here is there'll be a fallout, that Americans won't understand what's going on here, and it'll be down to Israel's ill. Instead of saying, our job is to expose and tell the truth like Thane does, it puts a greater burden of responsibility on us. But the responsibility is not to be quiet and not to then have to play catch up. We should be saying what's being said on JBS loud and clear. Tlaib and Omar are lying.
And they're Jew haters.
And they're Jew haters.
We have to actually use those words.
They're Jew haters who want to see the state of Israel destroyed. They support BDS. They want Israel destroyed.
Yeah.
That's what the AJC should be saying.
I agree.
That's what ADL should be saying.
Yeah.
And that's what the URJ should be saying. And it shouldn't be only ZOA who's pilloried because they say it they don't say it in a genteel enough way. But I do want you to speak to this for 1 second. What would be, what is your call to Jewish leadership at this point in time?
Look, I've been on your show for, 20 years now? When you discovered me years ago, before, we became friends, I was minding my own business. I was just a Jewish novelist. Minding my own business. You had me on your show.
You were a liberal, by the way. A strong liberal advocate.
Two-state solution.
Civil rights advocate.
Two-state solution. I was a literary editor for Tikkun magazine. You simply
Tikkun magazine.
Could not possibly be more left.
Correct.
It's not possibly. For 6 years, I was their literary editor. What I started to see over the years, and that's wherein you kept bringing me back, and it appeared as if I had changed, but I had not changed. Everyone else had changed. I was still clear thinking and honest. I thought I was being honest. But I saw over the years that it became not a fair fight. I thought that Israel, on a number of things, but certainly the Second Intifada was the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. The withdrawal from Gaza that resulted in more rockets, the way Israel was being portrayed, despite all of this, and similarly, it did seem that even within Jewish leadership, there wasn't leadership. There was this: we don't want to make waves. We have other agendas.
We don't want to make waves. That's what I feel people are saying.
And also, there's this other thing. There's this sense of broader political considerations. People in those positions always say, you're not sitting in my chair. If you were sitting in my chair, you'd see how it's more like a chess game. And I have to do this, and I have to do this. And one of the beauties of being me is I'm a free agent. I was a law professor all these years. I'm on my own. No one owned me. I was able to speak freely, and I have been speaking freely. What has been disappointing is the point that you said before. I love the way you said it. I hope your viewers pick up on it. Never again had two meanings. And the second meaning was more important. The first meaning was really for the world. The second meaning was for us. That's more important. So what happened? Survivors are still here, and we're still doing the same thing. Isn't that really embarrassing? That we couldn't even wait, and we're still doing the same thing. It'll go away. I don't want to make waves. Who am I to make a stink out of this? I don't want to ruin my interest. I have an access over there. And if I say something over there, I'll lose my access. I have donors that are yelling in my ear about something. There's always a reason to do nothing. And that's what we see. This is the real curse of humanity: complacency, apathy, the desire to shut the blinds when the neighbors are being taken away in the middle of the night and say, what business of this is this of mine? And so I don't really have an answer. I don't understand why, even here in Jewish leadership, mm-hmm. that there's still ambivalence when it's so demonstrably true. What you're seeing now is demonstrably true. And you're seeing right wing and left wing. You're seeing on both sides. And that's what's most troubling, that you know, yes, Jews are comfortable in the United States, but I've said to you in the last several years, I'm growing deeply pessimistic. I think we're headed in a really bad spot, and there are indications. One of these days we'll look back and say, you know, connect the dots. They were there. We just didn't take them seriously.
I only hope that the people who are in positions of leadership, who I adore them and I have enormous regard for them. I hope that at some point, you know, you say again, it's a chess game. I hear that all the time. No, at some point it's checkers, and you've got to speak out. And we shouldn't be repeating the exact same mistakes we made in the 30s and the 40s. And at this point, it's crossed the line. Omar and Tlaib have crossed the line. And it's really important in my mind that all the good people who are good start speaking out. And they're all welcome here on JBS to sit with me, and Thane and me, and to say anything they want. And they can bring any nuance they want. But at the same time, I'm encouraging them to use JBS and to use every wonderful platform they have, not to permit the kind of, these are vicious, malicious, anti-Semitic, hateful lies being spewed, to the extent to which Thane runs into a guy who says, you know what the problem with Israel is? In 67, when you were created, you went in and you took some land that belonged to the Palestinians. And I think that that story is so emblematic of the position Jews now find themselves in. And I'm really, this is what worries me. But, you know, people are very worried about anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism is horrible. It's always been here. I don't want to, I mean, the fact that any synagogue would be shot up, it's not the first time, is just horrific. At the same time, that's not what frightens me. What frightens me is if it becomes in any way entangled with the government.
Yeah.
And that's what I see now. And when that happens, a line is crossed. And at that point, people must marshal. They must marshal vocally. They must marshal economically. They must marshal with any weight they can. And we're far beyond where we should be making people enemies within the Jewish community. You know, if there are people on the far right who are articulate, well, good for them. People on the far left are not yet articulate enough, push them to be. And that's what I hope, you know, you and I can bring to the JBS audience and the community at large. And I promise our viewers, I promise you, and I promise our viewers, you and I are going to be speaking about this all the time.
I hope
until
so.
We see something changes.
Thank you, Mark.
It is always wonderful
you
to have you on.
You are a Jewish treasure.
No, you're the treasure. You are. Thank you, my dear friend. There you have it, the thoughts of Thane Rosenbaum, distinguished fellow at NYU Law School, founding director of a marvelous series of symposiums he runs called the Forum on Law, Culture, and Society. If you ever see it publicized in the Jewish Week, anywhere in the Jewish world, you want to be at one of his evenings. He's an award-winning novelist, and his upcoming book to be published in March is Saving Free Speech from Itself. You know we have to do a program on that as well.
I'm hoping that we will.
We absolutely will. My thanks, as always, to our director, Sloan Copeland, JBS's associate director, Dara Golub, technical supervision by Michael Paley and Albert Kahn, and transmission manager, John McDevitt, and to the producers of this extended edition of In the News, Tisha Bader and Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Be well, my friends.